So you're here on WHUS 91.7 FM. I am Fran Storch, and for the next hour, you will be here listening to Radio Naturopath. And I am here with my co-host, Ron.
Good morning.
Yeah. So we'll be on trying to enlighten you in terms of medicine, natural medicine, and anything that you are interested in talking about. So we do encourage you to call. The number to call is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can text us at that same number, 860-486-9487. And you can email us at radionaturopath@gmail.com. And we'll be very happy to take your calls. So we have a call now. But I am going to jump in while Ron is taking your very delightful call. And in the meantime,
morning.
Talk to you about some interesting stuff. So one of the things that we're interested in is, I'm going to title this section, Food and Aggression. Okay? How can food make you more aggressive or even less aggressive? Food can definitely, and we're gonna at the risk of rhyming here, can affect your mood. Food and mood are a thing. Right? So there's some things going on in the world and in our environment that can affect how our food is prepared and whether you have mood issues with it. So let's start with something really obvious, hormones in food. So first of all, if you are not buying organically produced meat or meat where you know the farmer and you know the farmer is not adding hormones to the animals, hormones are given to animals to make them grow faster. So there can be extra growth hormones in meat. And if meat is not known whether it has growth hormones in it, it could have some in it. And this is more likely to be the case with mammals than fowl. I believe that fowl are not, they're not allowed to add hormones to fowl. But a lot of fowl, if you buy turkey or poultry, any kind of poultry, chicken or turkey, you're going to find that there haven't been hormones added to them. When you, in terms of meat, in terms of red meat or pork, you don't know unless it says that they haven't added hormones to them that, to help the animals to grow. And so the unfortunate thing is that things that make you grow, to make the animals grow, can make you grow as well. And things that make you grow tend to have emotional aspects to them. Both estrogen and testosterone have emotional pieces to them. If you are estrogen sensitive or if you have an estrogen dominance, women who are estrogen dominant tend to be irritable and they can be more aggressive. And certainly they can be more irritable. One of the things you see with PMS, for example, when a woman has premenstrual syndrome, one of the things that's going on is that her progesterone is dropping faster than her estrogen. And when you are relatively or even absolutely estrogen dominant, estrogen, when not balanced by progesterone, can make you irritable. So with too much estrogen or too much estrogen relative to progesterone, you tend to be swollen, you tend to overgrow. And when things are going through growth, they tend to be cranky. Take a look at your teenage son. One of the things that I see with my teenage male patients is that they will go through a growth spurt, they'll go through a growth phase where then all of a sudden you'll find that they're eating everything in sight, they're irritable, and then they'll grow an inch. And it doesn't take very long. And so that's what you see. There is a connection between growth and irritability. And like I said, you see it. Whenever testosterone and estrogen dominate. And the interesting thing about both estrogen and testosterone is that they are proliferative hormones. They are hormones that cause growth. And so when you dominate in them, you're going to tend to be more irritable and you're going to tend to be more aggressive. Why is that? Well, to some extent, estrogen, when it is dominating, and testosterone as well, cause some degree of inflammation. They have to do that in order to cause proliferation. That you have to have, if you're going to have growth of a tissue, you're sending more stuff to an area. So remember we talked about inflammation a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. The four cornerstones of inflammation. Two more, rubor, calor, and dolor.
Right.
Yeah, two more means growth of the area. Rubor means redness. dolor means pain, and calor means heat. Well, if you're going to grow anything, if you're going to grow a muscle, a breast, an organ, whatever it is, you have to send more stuff to the area, so there's going to be some degree of inflammation. Inflammatory compounds make you cranky. That's just what they do. When they hit the brain, that is part of what happens. When you have neuroinflammation, the nerves are not calm. So if there are inflammatory compounds running around anywhere in your body, you're going to have some degree of neuroinflammation, and that's going to translate into your brain. So if you have an excess of estrogen, or even if you have what would be considered a normal high level of estrogen or testosterone in a growing child, you're going to be cranky. Now, you go around putting those in animals for our consumption, and so now you have a situation where everybody's eating them, from, you know, a baby who's weaned, who's now eating meat, all the way on up to an elderly person and everyone in between. So you're getting a level of hormones, because they don't put hormones in to balance the growth hormones that they're putting in. They just put the growth hormones in.
Right.
So they're going to be analogs of things like testosterone and estrogen, mostly testosterone. So they're going to be analogs that help the animal flesh to grow. And those things, so now you have other problems besides the fact that they are testosterone analogs. Your body looks at them and doesn't recognize them because they're not the same hormones that are found in your body. So your body doesn't know what to do with them, and you wind up storing them. And where they get stored is in your fat. And one of the problems with fat, a person with a normal amount of body fat is going to store toxins in their fat, because that's part of how your body takes care of you and protects you. If there's something in your body that your body doesn't want running around, it's going to send it to the fat to hang out there. So if you are then obese or overweight, which most people in America are, you've got some inflammatory compounds sitting there. And because fat is dynamic tissue, it doesn't just sit there. Sometimes they come out. Even if you're not losing weight, you are going to use your fat as a fuel just to get from here to there. And so if a fat cell breaks down and sends out some fat so you can burn it, so you can just do something, like, you know, walk upstairs, some of that inflammatory compound is going to be released into your blood. So when you ingest these inflammatory compounds, whatever they are, so in for example, these anabolic steroids that are in meat, they're going to sit in your fat and they're going to be there waiting for you, and they're going to tend to make you more aggressive, which is why vegetarians say that people who eat meat can be more aggressive.
Well, that would make sense, wouldn't it?
Right.
Right.
So here's the problem. If you eat meat at all, if you eat anything that comes from an animal, whether it has added hormones or not, it has hormones in it because it comes from an animal.
Right.
I hate to say this, but milk is filtered cow's blood.
Oh, that's an interesting way of looking at it.
That's what it is.
It sort of is, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, there's no red, but not supposed to be any red or white blood cells in it, but that's what it is.
Right. It has to get processed through the cow's body,
yes.
So it's got to come from the bloodstream.
That is one way of looking at it. So
that is.
Even if you're having grass-fed, no hormone-added milk, there's hormones in milk. There's no way around it.
No matter how you look at it, sure.
Yes.
Sure.
And so the other thing about milk has casein and whey. Casein and whey are proteins that are intended to make little animals grow to be very big animals. And so when you consume casein and whey, especially the casein and whey from another species, they're going to make you grow too. They cause some degree of inflammation because that's what they're supposed to do. That's what they're designed to do. Part of growth, normal growth, is inflammation. If you go to the gym and work out and so you grow your muscles big, or if I go out and I do an interval training bike ride and I grow muscles, I'm causing inflammation. That's a normal sort of inflammation. In fact, inflammation is something that has to occur in your body. If you are unable to produce inflammation in your body, you will die, because you have to have inflammation to grow muscles, to maintain muscles, to grow new muscles. You have to have inflammation to fight microorganisms all the time, or else you would be sick all the time. If you couldn't make inflammation, that's called HIV. Any kind of immunodeficiency for whatever reason. So you have to have some inflammation going on. But like anything that's intense, it needs to be balanced. So when you put hormones in food, people are getting these levels of hormones that they're not supposed to have, and they are growth hormones. And what did I say? Growth hormones cause inflammation. Inflammation, when present, can cause neuroinflammation, which is going to make you cranky. So anything that causes growth is going to cause inflammation, and especially if it's not balanced with things that reduce inflammation. So you've got other problems. This is going to be depressing.
Oh, boy. Okay.
because you have xenoestrogens in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So xenoestrogens are things like your parabens that are in a lot of people's health and beauty products. So a good thing to do would be to check your health and beauty products to see if there are parabens. The names will be methylparaben, propylparaben, butylparaben. There might be others too, but those are three that definitely exist. They are estrogen-like compounds. They stimulate estrogen receptors. And your body can't break them down the way they can break down actual estrogen because our enzyme structure is not such that it can break it down. So those things are going to go hang out in your fat. They're going to irritate you and inflame you. And that's why there's a concern around them with causing reproductive cancer. Because when you have a proliferative hormone like estrogen, you're supposed to be able to break it down. You're supposed to have hormones that can break it down. And you're supposed to be able to have tags in your liver, like your conjugation process, which tags a hydroxyl group, that is a little oxygen and hydrogen, to the estrogen to make it water soluble. So you poop it or pee it out. And that's how you maintain normal levels of hormones. You're also supposed to have balancing hormones on board. Men and women both have progesterone. And progesterone is a lovely hormone that when in balance with estrogen, it moderates estrogen effects. It's not a proliferative hormone. It's a mediating hormone. So it does things like it actually turns off proliferation. So, for example, when you ovulate, you women, when you ovulate, and I say you women because I'm pretty sure I don't do that anymore. Do I look like a person who doesn't ovulate?
I don't know if I can answer that.
What a question.
That's a tough question.
That's a tough question. That's probably a three.
Yeah, you backed me into a corner on that one.
Yeah, I know. Yep. Right. So,
yep. Typical.
So when you... So when you ovulate, you have your FSH and LH from your pituitary telling your ovary to make an egg. And then the egg is supposed to split, and half of it becomes future potential baby, and half of it becomes corpus luteum. Corpus luteum's job is to make progesterone. Progesterone's job is to tell the rest of the ovary, okay, that's it, because nature really intended for humans to be uniparous.
Uniparous?
Yeah. You're only supposed to have
nothing to do with France.
Oh, Paris, right.
Right.
No, this is Parous.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you're only supposed to have one baby at a time.
Oh.
Yeah.
That doesn't always happen.
That doesn't always happen, but that's what's supposed to. Most of the time, it is what happens.
Mm-hmm.
You're only supposed to have one baby at a time. Humans were not really designed to have multiple births.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really good for us. And, I mean, it happens. People have twins. People have multiple births.
Oh, yeah.
And people survive it. But humans were, whereas, you know, an animal like a cat or a dog, they're supposed to have litters. And they are supposed to have more than one baby at a time. And then they're larger animals, not so much. So your cattle, you know, your cows, your goats, your sheep, they don't have litters.
Mm-hmm.
So they're higher in the more highly evolved animals do not have. They have only one baby at a time.
Okay.
Or maybe I don't know if it's higher, more evolved, because to say that a cow is more evolved than a dog, I'm not so sure about that. Maybe it's just a size thing. Dogs are pretty evolved.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, dogs can.
They just don't like to be hugged. That's all.
As far as we know.
As
and that's controversial.
Know. Yeah.
You know, they like to be petted because they'll roll over and let you rub their belly.
Right. And if you hug them, they get to lick you and they like to lick.
Yeah. Oh, they like to. Yeah. But licking is not entirely about
I know,
love.
It's a communication thing.
It's an information seeking
right,
thing.
Right. It's a probe.
Yes.
Right.
That's right.
Right. We're off track.
Yes. And so. So, as I said, humans are only supposed to have one baby at a time. And so what progesterone does when you make that corpus luteum is it turns off the ovary and says, okay, that's enough. No more follicles because we're only going to have one baby. And that's progesterone's job. And then progesterone goes and ripens the uterine lining so that you can have a nice bed for the baby to rest in until it becomes ready for birth. And so progesterone is not something they put in meat or progesterone analogs. Why would they? It's not a proliferative hormone.
Okay.
So you know how women talk about when we're menopausal, when we have PMS, or certain times of the month we're cranky?
No, really?
Yeah, because we're estrogen dominant.
Hmm.
Or if women are cranky a lot, if you're a woman and you're often cranky and bloated and emotional, you may be estrogen dominant. And how you get to be estrogen dominant is because of xenoestrogens in the environment, PCBs, which mm-hmm. are breakdown products of industry, dioxins, which are also breakdown products of industry that are used in bleaching paper. And,
plastics.
BPAs,
right,
plastics, exactly.
Right, right.
Things in plastics.
So we're like surrounded by all this.
By xenoestrogens, and we're not surrounded by xenoprogesterones.
Okay.
So you're more likely to encounter an estrogenic substance in the environment than you are, or a proliferative substance in the environment than you are to encounter a moderating substance in the environment. So you're going to be cranky from that, and it's going to make you more aggressive. And this is true for men and women. So both men and women are exposed to these compounds. So this is going to make people crankier. So the other issue we have, my thesis is how food can food creates aggression.
Right. Well, we were talking about this the other day.
We
brought up the subject of, you know, why are people so cranky all of a sudden? And it seems like they're more so cranky than they used to be.
So this is only one aspect of
right.
it, certainly. But this is my hypothesis for the day is why food is making people more aggressive.
So food is one of the contributors.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And that's where I'm going with
this. Because
our
food is so modified and so controlled by different substances that it tends to throw this out.
Where I'm going with this is there's specific scientific reasons why. I'm not doing this in like a nebulous, oh, it's making you cranky because of this. There's specific reasons why. And
mm-hmm.
so we went through the hormonal piece where if you have too much in the way of proliferative hormones, you're going to be angrier. You have more inflammation, so you're going to have more neuroinflammation. Neuroinflammation, your nerves are inflamed. They're not calm. You are not calm. You're going to get angrier.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the one of the positions that I'm taking. So that it's hormonal. And so the other way that people become estrogen or testosterone dominant is because of stress. So
mm-hmm.
men and women both produce progesterone. You know, women produce progesterone. We get progesterone nicely from the corpus luteum. Now, of course, when you become perimenopausal and menopausal, you're past your menopause, anyway, you're not ovulating anymore, it's much harder to make progesterone. So you can get cranky when you're my age. I'm trying not to be cranky. Things do tend to balance out after a while because your body figures out how to make estrogen and progesterone from other sources, but you don't have as much. And if you look at the normal hormone profile of a woman who is past her menopause, her estrogen and progesterone are going to be low. And if she's going to be calm, she has to figure out other ways to do it. Now, you do make some estrogen and progesterone from your fat and from your adrenal glands. So this is the other thing, that we have an issue with obesity in our country. And as I said, body fat stores inflammatory compounds to protect you from them so you don't have inflammation in your body all the time. But it can't hold on to them all the time because when you move, you use fat. And so if a fat cell is holding an inflammatory compound, it's going to dump it into your bloodstream. So you got that going on. And then if you're progesterone insufficient, you don't have anything to back that up and make you calmer. So the next piece is that any progesterone that you have, if you are under stress, progesterone has an easy two-step process to be converted to cortisol. So cortisol mm-hmm. is your fight-or-flight hormone, the hormone that you get to use when you're running around doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we tend to be progesterone insufficient because we're estrogen. We're relatively progesterone insufficient because we're estrogen and testosterone dominant, and we're absolutely progesterone insufficient for a number of reasons. So women tend to be progesterone insufficient because because of the toxins in the environment, how many women? There's a lot of women who have trouble conceiving. And that's because there's issues with their eggs. And why are there issues with their eggs? Because they're exposed to all the stuff in the environment. Mm. And they're exposed to a lot of stress.
Of course, stress is a big one there, too.
Once you're exposed to stress, like I said, so you ovulated, right? You made a nice egg, which could theoretically be your kid eventually. But you got that corpus luteum making progesterone. But you have a big presentation to do in a week, and you have got to work on that presentation. Well, guess what? Your body doesn't know.
The egg's compromised now.
Right. Well, the egg's not just compromised. Your progesterone's compromised. So your body doesn't know the difference between running away from a bear and making a presentation. It just knows that you're under stress. So it's going to make some more cortisol for you. So it's going to make cortisol directly from your adrenal glands.
And you don't need the cortisol. What you really need is the body understanding that, okay, the egg is healthy and everything in the body is healthy to protect the egg. So let's have a baby.
But that's not going to happen if you're under stress.
Right.
Because the body knows that when you're in high cortisol, that's a bad time to have a baby. So cortisol suppresses reproductive hormones. And that's to protect you so you don't get pregnant. If you have to run away from marauding invaders, you don't want to be pregnant.
Right.
So because you're pregnant, you can't run.
Right.
So if you're under stress, your body's going to be, it's much harder to conceive. And there's neat ways why this happens. When your adrenals are busy shooting out that cortisol, they actually suppress the activity of the reproductive gland. So it suppresses your ovarian function. And it will probably, to some extent, suppress testicular function, although I don't think to the same extent. The difference between men and women, I mean, when you are making sperm, you run, you're sitting there, you're making sperm right now.
Okay.
Is that like so silly? And
well,
you're 61 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And you're still doing it. I have a finite number of eggs, and my eggs have been around for 52 years, so they may not be so great anymore. And so whatever eggs I have left, and my body's like, all right, you're done, you know, so I don't get to ovulate anymore. But you men continue to make sperm through their lives. And so they are less likely to be affected by stress and their ability to conceive, which is not to say they are not affected, because they can be. And certainly stress can suppress testosterone function, because, I mean, not you, Ron, but I do see people, men come into my office who are under stress whose sex drive is reduced. And that makes sense, because, like I said, cortisol suppresses reproductive function, and with good reason. It's not a good time to have a baby if you're under stress. And nature knows that, and nature has that hormonally worked out for you. So the other interesting thing about nature is that progesterone that makes the nice bed in your uterus so you can have a nice baby, and that also says, all right, rest of the ovary, no more follicles, we're only going to have one baby. That progesterone has a two-step process to get converted to cortisol. So your progesterone, this lovely hormone that chills you out, makes you calm, makes it so you could have a baby, makes you feel good, makes you feel happy, makes you feel fine. It gets turned into cortisol easily.
Mm-hmm.
So now if you have less progesterone, you're more inflamed, you have more cortisol around, and you're not likely to conceive. And because you're lower in progesterone, you're more likely to be cranky and aggressive. So that because nature wants you to be aggressive if you are in danger, because nature's basic interest is in your survival. So either the species is going to survive by fighting off marauding invaders, or it's going to survive by reproduction, but it's not going to do both at the same time, and that's how we're wired.
Hmm.
Is that like so interesting?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah. So that is another way that food causes aggression, because of the increased level of proliferative hormones and the relative and absolute reduction in the relative and absolute reduction in progesterone. Progesterone is a peace hormone.
Hmm.
So we have a peace hormone, PEACE, peace hormone, progesterone.
Right.
We also have a peace mineral. And this mineral is known as the grand peacemaker. In homeopathy, we talk about people who are of this remedy essence. They are the peacemakers. They're not very tolerant of conflict. And they will either try to stop conflict. They'll be the ones who are trying to stop the conflict, or they will walk away from the conflict because they can't take it. Mm-hmm. So the peace mineral is
magnesium.
You got it. Okay. Yep. So magnesium.
And magnesium is missing from our soils because we deplete it from our soils.
Yes, and we don't put it back in.
Right.
Unless you're Brian.
Unless you're a good organic farmer that understands how this whole concept works, and
right.
you've been working on trying to get your soils back to where they were 40 or 50 years ago when they still had lots of magnesium.
So magnesium and progesterone are peace. So what's the deal? So low magnesium, I can take you from low magnesium to war.
Well, yes, I can see that.
So this is another way, this is another reason why food makes you aggressive. And because people don't consume enough magnesium. So where do you find your magnesium? Guess what? In produce, especially organic produce, especially green stuff. So anything that's a leaf is going to have a lot of magnesium in it. Why? Because chlorophyll is the compound in plants that does most of its metabolism. It does wonderful metabolic things for it, and it takes the light from the sun and converts it to energy for the plant. And it's the same compound as hemoglobin in our blood. Hemoglobin does oxygen exchange for us. It takes oxygen that we breathe in and puts it into our cells so we can have metabolism and do stuff. And then it will pick up carbon dioxide and take it out. And then we have this wonderful cycle where, you know, your lungs do gas exchange. You breathe in oxygen and you breathe out carbon dioxide. And it's all in concert with this wonderful compound called hemoglobin, which has a heme ring, and at its center it has iron in it. Well, the exact same compound is found in plants. It's called chlorophyll, but instead of having iron in the middle of it, it has magnesium. So anything with chlorophyll in it has magnesium in it. And guess what I hear from all my patients? Not all of them, but a lot of them. I don't eat my veggies. I don't eat enough veggies. And what people tend to eat the most of that I see is starch. They eat starchy foods, and they tend to eat white starch. And white starch, I can tell you, has little to no magnesium in it. So when people are not eating their veggies, they're not getting their magnesium. Or if they are eating their veggies and the veggies are not organic, they're not going to get the magnesium that way either. And magnesium is a very important mineral. Magnesium keeps you calm. It keeps the nerves calm. If you have neuroinflammation, it can combat that. If you're very physically active, you use your magnesium. Your magnesium helps to moderate the activity of your muscles and helps to keep them calmer and helps to keep you out of cramps. So it helps with regular muscle contractions and regular nerve function. And so when you're depleted in magnesium, that's not going to happen. So again, if you're depleted in magnesium, you're going to have nerves that work in a cranky fashion, and you're going to be crankier and therefore more aggressive. So we have a situation where people eat probably more meat than they should. They certainly eat more starch than they should. They may or may not be eating adequate levels of produce, and produce has calming minerals in it, and it's going to have more calming minerals if it's been grown by a savvy organic farmer, somebody who really knows how to work the soil and make sure that there's good minerals in it. So magnesium, like progesterone, is a moderating mineral. It moderates growth. It makes it so that growth doesn't happen in excess. So you know how So one of the things that you get told when you're a woman as you get old is take calcium, take calcium, take calcium, take calcium. Because calcium causes bone growth. And it does. It's true. But calcium, like estrogen, if it's by itself, it will cause rampant bone growth. It'll cause excessive bone growth. And if you take too much calcium and you don't take magnesium with it, you're going to get too much calcium growth. And what will that lead to? That will lead to things like kidney stones and overgrowths of tissue, like calcifications and what we call exostoses. You know, your little bone spurs at different points in your body, and they can be anywhere where you tend to have irritation where bones are rubbing against each other, at joint spaces and your vertebrae and your heels. Places where you use the bones a lot and the bones are making contact with each other, you're more likely to get calcifications. And so taking a lot of calcium is really not a good idea. It's more important to take the things that moderate calcium than it is to take calcium itself. And in fact, unless a man really has a good reason to take calcium, like maybe he's sweating it out a lot because he's a triathlete, or because he's actually been diagnosed with osteoporosis, you don't tell a man to take calcium because they've got so much testosterone. Testosterone just oversees growth so much that you encourage men to get their calcium from food, and you encourage everyone to get those moderating minerals and those things that moderate calcium, like vitamin K2 and vitamin D and magnesium. So magnesium one of the things magnesium does is it competes for a solution with calcium. So if there's more magnesium around, calcium is less likely to come out of solution. It balances it that way. And it also calms down magnesium growth. So, it calms down calcifications and excessive growth. And because magnesium calms nerve and muscle function, you're likely to be less irritable. So, there's actual diagnoses, various diagnoses that people get when they are irritable and anxious. So eating a good diet really can cause these things. I have another thread.
Not
that
eating
I wanna...
a good diet can cause these things.
Right. Yeah. Oh, right, yeah. Right, so I have another thread to go through in terms of. So we've talked about progesterone.
Yeah.
We've
I have
talked
a couple
about
of callers
magnesium,
too, when we get through.
And the third thing I have to talk about is blood sugar regulation. But let's take the questions from the callers. Go ahead.
Well, we have a couple of different callers. These are off subject from what you're talking about. So I don't know if you want to finish up what you're doing first.
Okay. I can do that. Let's do that. Okay. So let's go to the third thread of how food can make you cranky and make you aggressive. And that's blood sugar dysregulation. So one of the things that you see is that people eat a diet that doesn't regulate their blood sugar well. And there's a few culprits there. One of them is modern wheat. So I can take you from modern wheat leads to aggression. And so here's the problem with modern wheat. As we already talked about how dairy can make you aggressive because dairy, and it's not necessarily going to make you aggressive, but it can. And my hypothesis there, my thesis there is that the whey and the casein cause growth, therefore inflammation. Therefore, if you don't back that up with calming stuff like magnesium and essential fatty acids and produce in general, you're going to have more aggression just from dairy. And dairy also contains hormones that can make you aggressive. So now we're going to go to wheat. So modern wheat. So I'm not talking about einkorn, and I'm not necessarily talking about spelt. I'm talking about modern wheat. How on earth can modern wheat make you aggressive? Well, there's a number of I have a number of theses here. One of them is the inflammation. So gluten. Now you're going to say to me, "There's no reason to be gluten free if you don't have celiac disease," and I think that's a false hypothesis. So the issue is, like I said, it's with modern wheat. Now, if you don't have celiac disease and you get tested by your friendly local naturopath and they find that you're not making antibodies to gluten, I do tell those people, if you want to try it and you're not a person who does better with a grain free diet, go eat some einkorn, see what happens. I'm one of those fortunate people. I can eat some einkorn. It's fine. I don't eat einkorn every day, but once a week, maybe less, Ron makes me a nice bowl of einkorn pasta and I eat it happily, and then I go on my nice bike ride the next day. It's very nice. And einkorn is delicious. But you can't have it if you make antibodies to gluten. So, and Ron, because we don't know, he hasn't tried it yet. So
no, I'm not willing to do that yet.
Right, because we don't have antibody evidence.
I need
on
to have
you.
Some vacation days before I can do that.
Right, I know.
Because it really makes me ill.
Right, well, because gluten makes you really ill. Yeah, right. And I don't have that problem. And I also tested my antibodies, and I tested my antibodies while I was eating gluten, and I don't make them. We unfortunately, at the time that we took Ron off gluten, he was unable. Well, he didn't have health insurance, so he didn't want to pay the money to do the gluten testing. So we don't have antibody evidence as to whether Ron has celiac disease or not. So it's tricky for him to try to eat gluten, because every time he tries something that has any gluten at all, he gets sick. Mm-hmm. So we're assuming that he makes antibodies to gluten. We don't know for sure, but that's the assumption we're
making.
It's
not worth going there.
Not worth going there because
it really isn't.
And you don't feel good.
It's very unpleasant.
Right. So wheat and blood sugar, how does that relate? So if you're a person with diabetes, you should be looking at whether you want to eat modern wheat. Here's why. So gluten causes inflammation in everyone. It's just a matter of degree. When gluten hits the lining of your small intestine, it stimulates the zonulin pathway. And the zonulin pathway causes the tight junctions of the small intestine to break apart, and it makes your villi more porous, meaning those little finger-like projections where you absorb your food, makes them more porous, so you're more likely to absorb anything and molecules that are bigger than you're supposed to absorb in the rest of your system, and you're going to get more inflammation. So more inflammation. We've already posited this, that inflammation leads to aggression. All right, so that's one mechanism. Another mechanism is wheat germ agglutinin. Wheat germ agglutinin is something that's in wheat, and it is it's a xeno hormone. It's an endocrine disruptor. It will bond to endocrine receptors and stimulate hormonal things, and among them estrogen and testosterone receptors. So wheat germ agglutinin, that's one of the ways it works. It also will stimulate a rise in insulin. Once you have a rise in insulin, insulin causes inflammation. Insulin causes growth. Insulin causes you to grow muscle. Insulin causes you to store fat. So it causes inflammation. You're going to be more irritable when you have too much insulin around. The next piece is the amylopectin A. And this is this in my estimation, is the biggie. Amylopectin A is going to be higher in white modern wheat flour than it is in whole wheat flour, just because the whole wheat flour has some bran in it and the bran doesn't have the amylopectin A. The amylopectin A is in the starch. It's in the endosperm. So the amylopectin A is this long chain starch that's only in modern wheat, and it raises blood sugar more than anything else we have in the food supply, even sugar. So it's worse for you. If you're diabetic, in my estimation, it's worse for you to eat modern wheat than it is for you to eat sugar. Actual sugar, just like a spoonful of sugar, right? Because that amylopectin A raises your blood sugar so much. So now when you raise your blood sugar, what happens there? Well, if your blood sugar is raised at the right time, like you're about to go and get some heavy-duty exercise, it's not a big deal. You're going to eat it up. But if your blood sugar is being raised because you have type 2 diabetes and you're genetically raising it and you're eating things that make it go up, your body's going to look at it and go, no, you can't have sugar that high. And your insulin's going to go, I'm coming out. I'm going to take that out of circulation because that's bad for you. Why is it bad for you? Because when sugar attaches to proteins in your body, it renders them ineffective. That is why having diabetes is so bad for you, because sugar attaching to protein, proteins are supposed to be smooth and slippery and sleek and nice. And when proteins attach to them, they become brittle and ineffective, which is why your blood vessels break and you lose toes and kidneys and go blind, and why the lens of your eye gets cloudy and you can't see through it. All right, so this is why all that happens. So your body's going to go, I want to get rid of this blood sugar, so it's going to send out more insulin, and the insulin takes the sugar out of the blood. Now your blood sugar has dropped, and if your blood sugar drops too much, your body doesn't like that because it has to have some sugar in the blood. So it's going to go send out, guess what? Cortisol. So now you're under stress again, and the one of cortisol's jobs, so you can run away from the bear, is to put sugar into your blood. So if you put too much sugar into your blood, guess what happens? You send out more insulin, and the insulin takes the sugar out of your blood.
Seems like a vicious circle.
So now you're in a psycho-aqua-do-loop. Thank you, George Clinton.
A cycle what?
Psycho-aqua-do-loop.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't find that anywhere. I know he had a song about a psycho-aqua-do-loop, and I think that's such a great word. I just can't find it.
Okay.
I'll have to ask Chris Green. Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, so you're in this cycle, and if you send out insulin all the time, your body's going, you can't be sending out all this insulin. Too much insulin is bad for me. It causes too much inflammation. Your body will start to make the receptors of the insulin on your cells less receptive to that insulin. And now you have insulin resistance. And when you have insulin resistance, your insulin goes, but I have to be out there. There's too much sugar in the blood. So your body sends out more insulin.
Okay.
And the insulin can't bond. So now you have high insulin in your blood. This is not a good situation. And one of insulin's jobs is to what? increase inflammation, increase growth. You have high insulin, you are cranky. Mm-hmm. So you have amylopectin A, you have high blood sugar, you have cranky. So so that's another mechanism by which modern wheat causes inflammation. There's another mechanism that's totally unrelated to the blood sugar thing about modern wheat. It's called glyphosate or Roundup. All right. So when they, a lot of farmers, when they are growing modern wheat and they're growing it with pesticides, when they're about to harvest the wheat, they'll dose it with Roundup. Why would they kill their wheat? Doesn't make sense.
Mm.
The reason to do that is because as the plant is dying, it's going to send out what do plants do as they're dying? They go to seed.
Yes, they do.
Yes, so yep. They produce more seeds before they die. Now you have a wheat that has more seeds on it, more production, more gluten. And so now you and before the wheat dies, it goes to seed, but they harvest it before it dies. Mm-hmm. So now you have a modern wheat that has more seeds on it and has more gluten. More gluten leads to more inflammation. Plus, you have residues of glyphosate on it, and glyphosate is a neurotoxin. Makes you cranky and aggressive, okay? So it gets better and better. And you have the hybridized dwarf modern wheat that has lots of seeds on it, so it has more gluten in it. So you got that going on, too. Then there's another thing, and this is what Miss Carla told us about, and that was that... they're not always careful about the conditions that the wheat is grown in, so there can be mold on the wheat. And mold can produce neurotoxins. So people overeat starch and sugar, and they mess up their blood sugar. And if you're eating modern wheat and it's not organic, there can be all kinds of exciting things in the modern wheat. And it's not just about the gluten. It's about all the problems with modern wheat. And
right. People
overwhelmingly eat
Pizza, sandwich.
Yes.
Right,
sandwiches for lunch.
Sandwiches and pizza over and over and over again. And if you're not eating pizza, you're eating pasta.
Right.
Quick comfort food.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And the pizza deal is because I don't have time to make dinner. That's the pizza deal.
But I make dinner in much less time than I can even make a pizza.
I know.
Not alone, pick up the phone and call out for a pizza.
I see so many families where they have pizza once or twice a week because it's easy, because they see it as dinner.
God.
Well, yeah, and that's the way it is. And, if you have a child who's been raised on starch and sugar.
That's all they want.
Right. It's very hard. You saw you saw my nephew who doesn't want to eat veggies. Yeah.
I know.
And that's how it is. And we're hoping he grows out of it, and he may, because my other nephew grew out of it. But that is something that parents deal with. They are very busy. They're very stressed. They don't necessarily eat their veggies, so they're going to have their kids eat what they like, too. And so everybody likes pizza. I mean, you and I, as much as we rag on people getting pizza, isn't pizza delicious?
It is.
Yeah,
it's great.
You and I love pizza.
I love pizza. I just don't eat it much.
We just
anymore.
Hardly ever eat it. Yeah, I know.
I really don't.
Well, the thing with pizza is, first of all, that wheat. The wheat gives you wheat is addictive because of all of the. Oh, and there's something else I forgot about.
There's also sugar in there. Well, that's also addictive.
Yeah, not so much. The wheat, it's more the amylopectin A. There's not really sugar unless they add. There could be sugar in the dough.
Yeah, it's in all our bread products.
But the sugar is not as much of an issue as the amylopectin A. That's the starch. That's really the issue. There's another issue with pizza in particular, and that's that. Pizza has an addictive quality because it's fat paired with starch. And when you pair fat with starch, it turns on neuropeptide Y in your brain. It turns off your satiety signal. So you just want to eat and eat and eat and eat. And then you have, the other thing I forgot about wheat and dairy is that they've got heroin in them. Now that's...
What?
Okay, I didn't say that right. They don't actually have heroin in them. But you can make gluteomorphines and caseomorphines when you eat wheat and dairy.
You can make them in what way? Processing them in your body?
Your body makes morphine-like compounds.
So it's going to make you feel better.
It's going to make you addicted is what's going to happen. So one of the things that you see,
okay.
I you will have, this is really interesting, if you find somebody with celiac disease or is making gliadin antibodies mm-hmm. and you want to pull them off wheat, they feel way worse before they feel better.
Oh, yeah.
Guess why?
Well, they're addicted to it.
They're going through
withdrawal.
They're literally going through opiate withdrawal.
I could see that.
Yeah. So this is why sometimes, you know, I think for the two of us, we should do a trial of no dairy and see what happens.
Well, I think that I'm not as concerned as the dairy. I'm much more concerned about the sugar right now.
Yeah, and there's that too.
I think sugar is the big one. Everything I'm reading about sugar right now is just, it's out of control. It's way out of control.
Sugar is an issue.
Sugar is a huge issue.
Yeah.
It's a huge issue. And, you know, there's the mass media is now starting to focus on it. It's getting that bad. So
on how much, because people eat way too much sugar.
Yeah, that sugar is causing a lot of disease.
Yeah. It's true.
So anyway, that's another story for another
time. Although sugar, are the mass media focusing on that? They're focusing on sugar, but they're not focusing on wheat.
That is correct.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm reading.
And I'm here to tell you, I know in my body and everything I read, the wheat is worse than the sugar.
Yeah.
The wheat raises your blood sugar more than the sugar does.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But the sugar is just horribly addicting.
It is.
That's the biggest issue there.
That's true. It is not as addicting as the wheat, though. It's pretty amazing.
Right.
Because I know when I eat wheat, I don't have a shut-off switch. When I eat sugar, I can stop. I'm like, all right, I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm like, I can't.
Interesting.
Yeah.
We still have a couple of questions we need to address.
We still have two questions.
So
all right, so let me make sure that I've wrapped up this the food and aggression. So so the three things with progesterone, magnesium, and blood sugar. Of course, there's there's processed food. There's chemicals in food that can lead to aggression as well. So if you're eating foods that have a lot of additives in them, they're going to be an issue. All right, so that's good. So we wrapped it. I think I've made my case that you have to be careful so that eating a lot of sugar, how do you not do this? You want to eat more produce and eat produce from places where you know the farmers, or at least you're getting organic produce, so you know that they're going to be higher quality. I mean, it's ideal to go to farmers markets and eat local and talk to the farmers you're getting your produce from. And do eat more produce and try to look at your wheat consumption and limit it, if not eliminate it. And look at your dairy consumption, whether that's really doing you any good. And in any case, the thing you should be eating the most of is produce. You should be eating more produce than anything else. Whatever that produce looks like for you is going to be individual, but mostly produce, a reasonable amount of protein, and the thing to be eating the least amount of is starch and sugar. And if you can limit those things, that you're going to go a long way to helping your health. So that's a very interesting thing. So, and there can be a lot of chemicals in food that can be concerning. So if your kid likes to eat M&Ms, it might be worth considering going to the health food store and getting the M&M analog that they have at the health food store, because instead of having chemicals in them that can cause neurotoxicity, you're going to be able to get fruit colorings that are extracted from plants that are not going to be a problem. If you like to eat gummy bears, they can have colors in them that are not good for you. And you can go to the health food store and you get little chewy gum. They're not the brand gummy bear, but they're little bears that are gummies, and they're flavored with fruit juice, and they're not necessarily colored. Or if they have coloring, they're colored with natural colorings, and they're not going to be a problem for you. Then you have the issue of preservatives. If you go to the health food store, you're going to find things that don't have preservatives in them, like BHT and TBHQ and other additives and preservatives, carrageenan and things like that. So they're avoiding preservatives and chemicals and colorings in food, those all by themselves can cause neurotoxicity. And there was a guy named Feingold who put together a diet for children who have ADHD that took those preservatives and colorings out. So that's another thing to look at. All right, hit me. Questions.
Okay, here we go. I've got Ron calling from Mansfield. not me, Ron from Mansfield, the other Ron from Mansfield.
Yes.
And he is going through the lovely little tick guy again. So he's got the Lyme disease issue, and he's got allergies to, he's allergic to the antibiotics, to doxycycline.
Okay. What,
and he wants to know if there's anything he can do that would help.
Well, is he only allergic to doxycycline?
He said antibiotics, so doxy seems to, but doxy was the one that he mentioned right away.
Yeah, but if he's only allergic to doxycycline, there may be an antibiotic that he's not allergic to. There's plenty of antibiotics.
So there's enough different ones out there that he should try different alternatives first?
And he should get somebody who's clever, who can work with him to find the right one for
right.
him.
I gave him a name over the phone,
yeah.
so
right.
of a direction that he could go. So maybe that would be the best thing, is to talk to somebody about
that. Yeah, if he
that.
Needs to have an antibiotic.
Right.
I mean, there's certainly natural medicine things that can help him, but if he's got acute Lyme, it's a good idea to go get an antibiotic.
And do you have a short list of natural medicine things that you can do in the meantime?
Well, sure. And again, acute Lyme, when you've just gotten Lyme disease, it's a really, really good idea to go get antibiotics.
Okay.
All right.
Asking Dr. Fran for a short list is always an amusing thing, too.
Right. Because I have to cover my tuchus. All right. Because I'm not going to tell somebody,
right.
you can take natural medicine instead of this, when my belief is that if I, Fran, have acute Lyme, I see an erythema migrans, I'm going to go get the antibiotic.
Right. Right. I understand.
Right. So, So other antibiotics, if you're not allergic to penicillin, you can take penicillin and its derivatives. So amoxicillin is a common one to take.
Mm-hmm.
And there's amoxicillin, and then there's the cephalosporins. So cephalosporins are commonly used for, if you're not allergic to the cephalosporins, you can use those. You can use erythromycin. It just depends on what you're allergic to, because lots of antibiotics, you can take a chance and take a fluoroquinolone. The issue with the fluoroquinolones is that you can get tendon disruption. So, I mean, you can break your Achilles tendon taking a fluoroquinolone. Not
Yikes.
Necessarily, but that can happen. So that's going to be your ciprofloxacin, your moxifloxacin, your anything that ends, levofloxacin, all those antibiotics like that. So he should talk to his physician,
mm-hmm.
and if he's allergic to doxy, he should get something else.
Right.
And yes, natural medicine-wise, I have products that I use that are mixed homeopathics. I have two different brands that I use. And then herbs like andrographis, cat's claw, sarsaparilla, and red root. Those are among my favorites. And teasel and stephania. Okay.
Okay.
And don't forget, if you're going to take an antibiotic, it's a good idea to take a probiotic, especially one with Saccharomyces boulardii, which can't be killed by the antibiotic.
Oh, boy, is it.
All right.
Okay.
So go ahead. Next.
All right. Second question came from a swimmer from Andover.
Okay.
And he is an outdoor swimmer, and he swims in Andover Lake, and most recently also in Coventry Lake. And he seems to be developing, or has developed, an allergy to lake water.
And oh, boy.
He's having respiratory issues from it.
Oh, goodness.
And I asked him when he got in the water. And first of all, he's around... I'm sorry if I got this wrong, but it sounded like he was around 70 years of age, swims daily,
yeah.
likes to swim, starts out in the lake in mid-June, and he doesn't have any reaction whatsoever to airborne allergens. So
could there be something in the lake that he's reacting
to? Well, that's exactly what's going on. And he's wondering if it's something that's actually in the water itself. And if you have any suggestions as to what he could do that might be preventative that would help him with that.
So the thing is, if you're getting into the lake, so he doesn't have like tree pollen allergies, and he doesn't have plant pollen allergies.
Right.
That may or may not be true, because when you're interacting with lake water, of course, the pollen gets on the surface of the water. We see it when we go by Mansfield Hollow Lake. You can see the scum
on
the water.
That's what I originally thought of, too, when I talked to him on the phone.
So that's one possibility that he's getting such a high dose of it because he's in the water, because it's all like just sitting there on the surface of the water, and he's breathing it in. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is, of course, there's all sorts of stuff in water, in lake water. There, you've got whatever's being kicked up from the bottom, and you've got all kinds of plants in the water. There's algae that grows in the water, and
that's interesting too, because he said that it was worse in Andover Lake than it was in Coventry in Columbia Lake.
Okay, so there's
might be a biological problem with the actual lake itself.
And which lake is bigger?
I
want to say Coventry.
Not Coventry, Columbia.
Columbia, sorry. Columbia is way bigger than Andover Lake.
So I think
Have you been in Andover Lake?
Yeah,
I actually have as well. It's not as it's a pretty big lake, but it's not as big,
as Columbia.
Columbia is like a small sea.
So there you go. You have more dilution for the pollution.
You
kind of
got
situation.
It. Exactly right.
Right.
When I used
right,
to,
right.
So when I lived in Halifax, Nova Scotia, one of the fun things to do in the summer was to go to the various lakes and go swimming because there were lots of lakes in Halifax. And that was popular to go to the lakes and go swimming. And they would actually get on the radio and they give you reports of which lakes you could go in. And sometimes some lakes, they would have to, the smaller lakes, smaller, more popular, easily accessible lakes, like Chocolate Lake was a bad one. It was popular and it was small and it was easy to access. It would close all the time because the coliforms would go
right,
up.
Right, right.
So what you have in lakes
too.
Is bacteria, you have algae, and you have bugs. And he may be allergic to a bug in the water. But the microalgae could be an issue, and is like you said, the bigger the lake, the less likely that is to be a problem.
And another thing he could try is swimming in the ocean.
Yeah, and see if that helps, and see what
because
happens
that's a,
there.
That's going to open a different scenario.
You're still going to have algae and stuff, but the neat thing about the ocean is it has salt.
That's salt,
in it,
though. That's what I was thinking.
Salt can be irritating, but on the other hand, salt can clean things out. If you're going in the ocean, you don't mind putting your face in the water. You're giving yourself a nasal lavage every time you go swimming. So some people who get allergies and have sinus infections, they go swimming in the ocean and they get better.
Segway to
neti pot.
What about a neti pot
afterwards?
There
of
you go.
Course.
So,
absolutely.
So the neti pot, if you're not familiar with it, Dr. Fran will tell you.
Yeah, you get the neti pot and you put salt water in and you clean your nose out.
And you clean your nose out.
Right.
And
you could do that with a neti
like
pot.
We use about a quarter teaspoon of sea salt in
depending
our.
Depending on, a quarter to a half, depending on the size of your neti pot, to your comfort. Mm-hmm. And you can use a drop of tea tree oil if you want to as well. And that'll kill anything that's in there. Because in your nose, you don't just have pollen and pollution. You always have bacteria and mold and viruses in your nose. So those are things that can be killed. I noticed when the last time I took antibiotics for my throat, my nose cleared up, even though I didn't particularly have a sinus infection. There's always stuff living in there. And even if you're allergic because you're inflamed because you're eating sugar or something, you're still going to have some bacteria. Okay. So, definitely using a neti pot, definitely use saline nasal spray, go for a swim in the ocean. If it's worse, you might need something like quercetin or vitamin C or something like that. Mm-hmm. All right. So
that's it.
Oh.
I mean, that's pretty much, except I have another call that came in from Dana from Baltic, who just is praising you, up and down, on how wonderful the show is and how much information that you put out for everyone, and just really wanted to give you a big shout out.
Thanks, Dana from Baltic. That's very nice. We like riding our bikes in Baltic.
We do. We ride through Baltic all the time.
Yeah.
So,
in fact, the entire town of Sprague is a good place to ride one's bike.
There's all sorts of great stuff
down
there.
So big shout out to Sprague and Canterbury for having awesome roads.
Yeah. And Dana. For listening.
And Dana for listening.
Yes,
yes,
and everyone else who's out there listening.
So I'm going to go now.
Okay.
So you're listening to 91.7 FM, WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch. This has been Radio Naturopath. And we will be back next week with more Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM.